The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on November 16, 2025. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Nice to see you all here on this beautiful fall day. I'm going to give a talk today that I've titled A Ripe Peach. So I'm going to talk about peaches for a little while this morning. Hope you don't mind. It's not really peach season, so it might seem a little weird I'd be talking about peaches, but for me, peaches are one of those fruits that are, when they're ripe, they are one of the most exquisite. I just love a ripe peach, and so they, for me, symbolize something about life, in part because if, like me, you not only love a ripe peach, you also don't like not ripe peaches. You know, ripe peaches are the best, right? They are great. They are heavenly. And unripe peaches are evil. You know, they're either not ripe yet, so they're hard. You know, nothing like you got a peach and maybe it's been sitting around in your house for a while. And you're going, well, it's got to be ripe by now. I've had it for almost a week. And then you bite into it and it's hard. And you just go, well, that is a bummer. Or the opposite, where you've had it maybe a little too long and you bite into it and it has no juice to it. It has no flavor to it. It might even be kind of mealy. It's just kind of soft and ew, you know. But here's the deal, and we know this, it's not the peach's fault. That's a little hard for us to remember sometimes. It's not the peach's fault. The peach is just being peach. Just, it's just there, right? And then we ascribe, based on our response to which we have, our preferences, we start to narrate what's taking on. And so for me, peaches become like a great metaphor for what we do in life, because life is a lot like that. If it's showing up in a way that we don't really, that we don't have preferences that we don't like, then it's like an unripe peach, you know, and we want to dismiss it, and perhaps we want to do something about it. So with those green peaches, we throw them in a paper bag and hope that that's going to help ripen the peach, right? So for example, we might be doing something in our lives. And then we always do something in our lives, but we might do something and this time it doesn't go the way that we usually expect it to go. So for example, we're taking a coffee mug out of the cupboard and it falls out of our hands and drops to the cupboard or it shatters, and hopefully it doesn't take anything else out with it. I had something fall out of the cupboard the other day and I went, oh no. And then it fell on something else and it broke the something else, but it in and of itself was just a little $1.98 thing. It survived. And then what we do when things don't go the way that we expect, we might just dismiss the experience like, well, that was an accident. Do you know what I mean? And then you just don't think about the experience at all. Or if, say, somebody else dropped the coffee mug, we might give them a little lecture on how to take coffee mugs out of the cupboard so that they won't do it again. So you see the instinct there to dismiss the experience or to try to correct the experience so that we don't have that experience again. And it doesn't matter how often you tell somebody how to take a coffee mug out of the cupboard, they're going to do it the way they're going to do it, and a coffee mug might get dropped, right? Or I think about, I used to listen to Car Talk. It was an NPR show, and I've been hearing one of those guys on the radio again. Pretty corny stuff. If you know Harry Shearer, who's a razor sharp satirist and a longtime vocal talent on The Simpsons, he does a lot of the voices on The Simpsons. But he's you know, few things about Harry other than the fact he's incredibly talented. He's also kind of snotty, and he hated Car Talk. He actually pulled his show from a radio station because they would always play him after Car Talk, and he thought it was the worst thing on the radio. And they asked him why, and he goes, they laugh at their own jokes. But anyhow, if you remember Car Talk, they did have this kind of running advice they would give you. If there was like a light on your dashboard and it was kind of driving you crazy. You know, you get those lights on your dashboard. I get one that tells me that my tires aren't inflated properly. And, you know, while that is important, sometimes it's just like a change in temperature or something, and then the tires will just kind of register a little different. And what they would recommend is just putting masking tape on your over the top of it so you wouldn't see the light going off. And I just thought, that is so perfect. That is what we do. You know, if we want to dismiss it, oh yeah, that light doesn't mean anything. And then we want to do something about it. In this case, kind of hide it, right? So what I want to point out is that you say something like this, that we have this tendency when life doesn't show up the way we want it to maybe try to fix it, to do something about it. And people might start to hear in that, well, aren't I supposed to do that? I mean, don't we take care of things that show up in our life? And I just say, of course we do, right? Buddhism is about taking care of our life. One thing that Buddhism doesn't do is it doesn't give you prescriptions about how to do or not to do particular things in certain situations, right? It's more universal in spirit. So what the teachings are that might teach us, give that a second look. It's more universal than telling you, don't do this, do this, don't do this, do this. So Zen is not about, or Buddhism is not about, you know, denying everyday life. So in everyday life, we've got to take care of things, but it's about taking care of everyday life. And that means taking care of things in a way that's grounded in what's actually taking place, as opposed to taking care of our ideas of what it is that's taking place. And when we have ideas about what's taking place, we have preferences. They will show up and say, life has shown up like an unripe peach right now. I really don't like this. So I'm going to do something to try to make it a ripe peach, right? And so what we're doing is, we talk about this in the Four Noble Truths class right now. When we live life, take care of life out of our preferences rather than out of what is actually showing up, what we're doing is we're getting caught at what, you know, we see an object and then we get caught at what we take it to be. I take it to be this thing, right? So if you know Buddhist teachings, you know, when we take something, we're talking about attaching to our idea about what's taking place. And in the Four Noble Truths class, we've been seeing how right view, which is the first of the Eightfold Path, right? Right view is not to see things as we take them to be, but rather how they have come to be. How they have come to be. And that is not a story that we tell about how they've come to be. We could do that. We're really good at that, telling ourselves all kinds of stories about how things came to just this particular moment. I have not read it, and I'm going to exaggerate only because I want to make sure you understand that it is supposed to be onerous to read. But it was Richard Wagner, the great classical composer, wrote some kind of book that, so like I said, I'm going to exaggerate here, 20 volumes of why all of history points toward the existence of Richard Wagner. We're good at that, and we're good at especially doing that about ourselves, narrating stories that say, this is why I have to be here right now doing this, right? We can explain that. And that's not what how things have come to be is. Okay? Instead, what we're doing is not creating a story. We're letting go of that impulse to narrate and tell stories and lay over interpretation over the top of life. And instead, realize how this, first of all, you can't really say anything about it. Anything you say is going to be short of the mark. It's just not going to be adequate. But how then, when we really see this, we see that all of reality is actually showing up. You know, it's inarticulable. I just said it, and in doing that, I just put some little phrase in there where either we're going to go, I don't get that, all the reality stuff. You don't understand what that's talking about. That's okay. You don't have to understand that. What we really are doing in our practice is seeing when we have to make a story out of it, or we have to have an explanation, or we have to have a preference, or whatever it is, and then we act out of that. And then realize that we're getting stuck at what we take the situation to be. We have a little, I don't know, you call it a prayer, you know, but it's a gatha or a little poem that we recite. and sesshins at our meditation retreat. And it's right at the beginning of, it's a longer poem, a longer gatha than I'm going to recite, but this is, you know, it's just a little reminder as we're sitting down to receive our food. In our chant book, it's written, innumerable labors have brought us this food. We should know how it comes to us. And I remember that when I first heard that, I had a dual experience. It was probably more than a twofold experience. The first was that it was really non-beautiful language. Innumerable labors have brought us this. It was just like, bleh. I didn't really like it, you know, and I was like, but I got past that because what it was saying was, that touched me the way that poetry touches me. Innumerable labors have brought us this food. We should know how it comes to us. Now that I don't do. You know, I sit down and start gobbling whatever it is, the peach, the ripe peach, right? But to really appreciate how it got here, how it came to be. And that doesn't mean, you know, just sort of the thank you to the farmers who grew this. And that certainly is part of it. And thank you to the market for selling it. And thank you to the market for selling these peaches rather than those ones that you never can get ripe for whatever, you know, no matter how much work you try to do. But there's more to it than that. So it includes all of that stuff that we can think about, innumerable labors that brought us this food. And a lot of people think it. They just start thinking about the trucks that delivered the food and the orchards and all that. But it's more than that. It's innumerable labor. So that ugly word that I didn't like in there is the key word. It's innumerable. You can't wrap your head around why this peach is showing up right now or whatever it is that's showing up in front of you. You just can't do it. So it's living out of that. Are we taking care of what needs to be taken care of because of our preferences, or it's because we're really living in this moment, out of aware of our preferences and then determining whether or not that's really something we need to act on. Acting out of our preferences is just acting out of business as usual, we might say. It's the way that we normally live our life. So what happens is something shows up, right? Something is taking place, and then we misunderstand that. We mistake what it is that's showing up. We get ideas about it. And then once we do that, those preferences are kind of linked to that. It's an interesting exercise is just to, you know, ask yourself, if you can just sit and just be without any kind of like commentary, if you can just sit and be fully present right now, open, living this, so totally open, and not doing the thing like, yep, I'm doing it, because that's what we'll do. So no narration. Just notice. And again, once I ask you to do this, then your intellect's going to engage. But see if you can notice no preference is arising at that moment. It's only once we start making something out of the situation that our preferences arise. And it could be like, ooh, this feels good. You know, sometimes when it's a cooler day and the sun is shining through that window, you know, sitting in Sushin in the winter and then the sun hits you, it can feel good. You know, and you go, oh, that's nice. Like a cat curled up in the window, you know, soaking up the sun. And sometimes that very same experience can be, ooh, this isn't very fun. You're sweating, you know, light's getting in your eyes, whatever it is. And that's the thing about our preferences. Is that, so first of all, these preferences show up. And as I was trying to indicate, they show up because we're making something out of the situation. But once we do that, then we actually treat our preferences as our understanding of what's taking place. So remember, something's taking place. What's taking place? Well, it's, I don't like this, you know. Now that is taking place, but we're closing our attention down onto that preference, and that becomes our understanding of what's taking place because we're not aware that it's our preference. Right? We're just acting out of the preference, if that makes sense. We're just acting. We're just like, we automatically do it. We take a left turn, you know, rather than a right turn. maybe because we have to get somewhere, but it could be that, you know, if you've ever done this, I wish I could remember that Bob Dylan lyric, because there's a good Bob Dylan lyric about it. But if you've ever seen somebody walking down the street and you go, oh, I don't want to talk to that person. See you cross the street. Maybe you're not like that, but this is sort of me. I'll just be like, hopefully they did not see me. So and if I look kind of the other direction, then they won't notice that I've seen them walking down the street. Now, I don't really do that so much because I don't walk down the street looking, you know, or in places where people can see me that I know. But I used to do this all the time. This was like a thing I would do, is I would just figure out who I didn't want to really talk to or interact with, and then try to rearrange my life in such a way that I wouldn't have to interact with them, you know. And I don't know how long this has gone on in my life, but as I'm telling you this, I realized, you know, I did this as a child as well, a little child. Like I had been in tea league baseball. Do you know tea league baseball, where you got to hit the ball off a tee? And I was not a very physically adept child. I was always a little awkward. And so I couldn't throw a ball very well. It's not like something that we did in my neighborhood. What I was good at was playing backyard football, and I could actually get that ball and run, and nobody could tackle me, you know. So I was good at that. It didn't translate into actual football position on the football team. They just went, oh, you got a belly, we'll make you a tackle. So that's, they would always put me in a tackle, and then the guys would just knock me out of the way. But the T-League baseball, I remember, so I still remember this, and I would have been in probably like third grade. But the ball came out to me, and they purposely put me in that place where balls usually don't go so that I wouldn't have to deal with it, right? But it came out to where I was, and I was way out there, you know, and it was a softball. You know, I took the thing and I threw it as hard as I could, which was as good as I was going to do. Getting it in a direction of something was not so likely. And that's why I just threw it as hard as I could. It didn't quite go, you know, toward home base. It went kind of some other direction. And some older kid was back there. Kid was in high school. What are you doing throwing it over there? Frazel, throw it over there. You just lost the game for your team. And he was yelling at me. And I remember going, oh, my God. You know, I didn't cry, but it certainly was that feeling. And so for the rest of the summer, I would go to baseball and get on my bicycle and just not go to baseball. I'd bike around town. But, you know, as a little kid, so my sense of time was really warped. And I came home once and my mom said, Steve, are you actually going to the baseball games? And I said, yeah. And she goes, well, it's just, you only left like 10 minutes ago. So I finally confessed that I didn't. So this is a thing that I have done in my life, is to avoid stuff. We all have versions of that, though, where life is showing up in a way we don't want it to, and we think we can control it. And we're just acting out of the preferences. We're not necessarily aware that we're doing it. It's just kind of a natural reaction that you have, you know. And the problem with those preferences is, as I already started indicating with the sunlight coming in the window, is that they're mercurial, right? They change. We don't have the same preferences, even for something that we have preference for, right? So when I was a little kid, I remember this too, I hated pepper. And if I saw pepper in anything, I wouldn't eat it. Now, I will say, this is before my mom remarried and I had a stepdad where I would have eaten it no matter what. But when I was with my grandparents and they were okay spoiling me, I would look inside, you know, like if it was a pot of soup, I'd look inside there and I go, I'm not going to eat that skin of pepper in it, you know. So, my grandma actually helped me overcome that. She had this tendency. I've seen her do almost literally the same thing with different people, different foods. But she cooked a soup, chicken noodle soup. I actually remember what it was. And then she asked me to look in it and make sure there was no pepper in there. I looked in and there was no pepper that I could see. So then she served me the soup and I ate it. And then she said, did you like the soup? And I said, I loved it, you know. And then she said, well, it had pepper in it, right? And then she put a can of white pepper down. She goes, it was white pepper, not black pepper. So you're okay eating pepper. So I don't want to hear this thing about pepper anymore. You know, and now I love pepper, but I wouldn't put pepper on a cake necessarily. Do you know what I mean? Like, so we have our preferences, but they're mercurial. Or this one that my husband told me, he was in a band for a while with this one guy that everybody who joined my husband's band for a while, they would have problems with this guy. And usually It was always the drummer, but the drummer would just be like, I can't deal with that guy anymore, right? So what he did one time is they wanted to play this song. We'll say it was Free Fallin' by Tom Petty, you know, something like that. And this guy goes, that is the worst song. There's no way we are doing Free Fallin' from Tom Petty. I hate that song. I mean, it's just, and he like went into a tirade about why it was the worst song ever written and performed in the world. And then my husband said about a month later, he goes, you know, we should do Free Fallin'. That's a pretty good song. My husband's like, what? What was the, you know? So our preferences come and go, and yet we root our lives in them. And it's mainly because we don't see that that's what we're acting out of. It's just kind of a reflex that we have. We remain leaning forward, you know, toward the things that we want, away from the things we don't want. We're going forward or backward, depending on our preferences. And that is living out of a life that's not a ripe peach, right? It's not a ripe peach. And our practice can be like that as well. Life itself is actually a ripe peach. We just don't treat it like that, right? So we treat it as if it's a not ripe peach. That's too hard, too soft. Our practice is like that. Our practice is life. So I say this because, well, what do we do about this living life as if it was a not ripe peach? Well, we've come to Buddhism. We take up Buddhist practice. We're at a Zen center. Like one of the things we do is we sit Zazen. That's what we do. But our practice can be like a peach. It can be too hard, right? It can be, just think of it as unripe. It's too hard. And by too hard, I think we can think of that. People jump into this practice and then they really work at it. They really work at it. And it could be that they sit every sitting that they can sit. Maybe they don't quite do that, but I've seen people do it. They just come in and all of a sudden you see them all the time. And it becomes unsustainable to do that if your schedule doesn't allow you to do it, you know. We sit to bring some kind of result about. That's why I came here. I came here because I was anxious and somebody said, you should meditate. If you're anxious, you should meditate. That will get rid of your anxiety. So I went, okay, right? And then I came here and I don't think the teacher said, you know, if you're here to cure your anxiety, it ain't going to work. But they did say this practice, Zazen, our meditation practice, isn't about bringing about some result. And I would hear that and I go, okay, you know, I'll see how that works. But in the meantime, I'm in the back of my head going, but yeah, it's going to take care of my anxiety. And so you sit and you work and you work and you work and you're expecting the thing that you want it to do. And so at the beginning, it was taking care of my anxiety. And that's a big thing. My anxiety was like a, I don't know, 1,000-pound purple dinosaur that was always hanging out with me. Do you know what I mean? Like getting rid of that, it's going to take some work. So I kind of went, okay, I just kind of let that go. But I started hearing about enlightenment when I was here, you know, to wake up. And I went, that's what I want to do. I want to wake up, you know. So then I would work really hard at waking up. And, you know, we have a story that we tell at Dharma Field. You know, it's one of the stories that gets passed down through the centuries of a teacher and a student. And the student, who ended up being a great Zen master by the name of Basso. But he was a really diligent student and he sat all day long. That's what he did. So one time his teacher, knowing that he had a good student on his hands, by the way, but he went and he talked to me. He just said, I notice you're doing all the sitting all the time. Why do you do that? You know? And the student said, well, I sit in order to become Buddha. And the teacher kind of looks around. There's a tile sitting over there. So he picked the tile up and he started polishing the tile. And he's polishing the tile. And he's polishing the tile. And the student goes, well, why are you doing that? And he said, well, first he says, what are you doing? Clearly, the teacher's polishing the tile. The teacher says, well, I'm polishing the tile. And he says, well, why are you polishing the tile? And he said, well, to make a mirror. And the student said, well, how can you make a mirror by polishing a tile? And the teacher said, how can you become Buddha by doing Zazen, right? So we have stories about this, how that's not quite what it is their practice is doing. But we might begin our practice, and we might, as we continue our practice, see that we're holding on to ideas about what it is that we're doing here. Like I said, it might change. And there's actually nothing wrong with those intentions that we have. We just have to see that we actually have them. Because otherwise, like I said, the practice becomes pretty untenable, unsustainable, if you're trying to bring something about. Because what's going to happen is, if you keep trying and keep trying, well, that's not what our practice is, and you're never really going to get the thing you're looking for. Which, if you look closely, that is the story of our life. You're never going to get the thing you're looking for, because what you're really looking for is this peace of mind, this stability that is Zazen practice itself. Right? So instead, though, we get stuck with that tile. So if our practice is too hard, it can be like that. We can just work too hard trying to bring some result about. But it can also be too soft, like those peaches that have sat around too long. It can be kind of rotten. Perhaps we're not trying, right? So we may tell ourselves all kinds of excuses, like, well, I'm going to sit today because, you know, I'm going to sit today because I can't do that today, because I'm not going to read that today because, and I'm not even going to fill that in because we know what this is like, you know, and you can fill it in with just about anything. So we're not trying. And perhaps this comes because we might hear a teaching like, and you will hear this here at Dharma Field, and you'll encounter it in books that you read, certainly from Zen teachers, and that is, you are Buddha. And you might hear, well, if I'm Buddha, then what's the point of doing this, right? It doesn't make any sense. So we get an idea about it. Or you might hear, as I was just saying, that our practice is not, this is a slightly different inflection, but our practice is not to improve ourselves, right? Really, what you're trying to do is you just want to realize the Buddha we are. And then you go, well, see, I'm already Buddha, so I don't really need to work that hard at this, or I don't need to go in. I'm just looking for my true self. Well, I'm always my true self, right? Isn't that what's going on? Well, yes and no, I guess we could say that. You know, it reminds me of the story, I've always was amused by this one, of Dinah Katagiri, who is Steve Hagen's teacher, so my teacher's teacher. And when he was earlier in his career, before he came to Minneapolis, he had taught in San Francisco. And he was in San Francisco in the 1960s. And if you have any sense of history, of course, most of us realize that was, you know, hippie central, right? So Katagiri was used to working with hippies on their practice. And he encountered one riding a streetcar one day. And he just asked the guy, he said, so where are you going? And the hippie replied, I don't know. Ask the streetcar. You know, and Katagiri goes, well, that sounds pretty good, isn't it? But that's not what our practice is, right? It's not just a whatever, man. Do you know what I mean? I'm open to how reality is showing up. Well, how reality is showing up is, you're a person. You got to do stuff. Do you know what I mean? That's life. That's reality. So that's just another idea we might have. So with this way of looking, you know, either trying to get something out of our practice or not even making an effort, right? Too hard, too soft. If you just look at it, no matter how you slice it, the practice is going to come up as not right. It's just not going to be right. Not doing anything about it, being soft about it, that's not going to help us to look at the problem and be relieved from the problem of dukkha. Right? The first noble truth, it's not going to do that. And working hard to get rid of it is not going to do that either. So when we're doing that, we, from that perspective, we're trying to do something with our Zazen or not do anything at all, right? We have an unripe peach on our hands, or at least it seems to us that we do. We have, what dawned on me when I was writing this, we have doppelganger Zen going on, right? It looks like Zen. Might look a lot like Zen, but it's not Zen. It's some idea that we have about Zen. Our practice, Zazen, is just to be this without any ideas. It literally translates, Zazen, as sitting meditation. Right? Za, sit, and Zen, their meditation. But as Dogen points out to us, right, the teacher that brought Chinese, this kind of Buddhist practice from China to Japan. And so from Japan, eventually to here right now, 13th century monk. And what he reminded us is that this meditation practice has nothing whatever to do with sitting or lying down, right? And we might hear that and go, see? See, that's what I told you. You know, I don't have to sit because meditation practice isn't about sitting or lying down. And then we get, you know, and then we're off on those ideas again. But what Dogen is trying to help us to see is that you can go ahead and sit on that cushion, you know, get your legs all like this, get your hands, you know, do all the sways and everything like that. And then you can just engage in business as usual. Huh. I didn't really like that meal I had last night. That thing didn't taste so good. But I did like the movie, though it was a little weird. I went to see a movie called Begonia the other night. It was a pretty strange movie. You know, so you there you are, and you're going, I wonder what I'm going to do later today. Kind of pretty day. Maybe I'll go out for a walk or, you know. You're not doing zazen. That's not zazen. You're just sitting in the posture, you know. So it's about bringing yourself back to this, not allowing yourself to get caught up in the daydreams that you have, not to get caught up in your fantasies. We have another word, actually. So we have zazen, sitting meditation. Oh, the other thing that is pointing out to us, by the way, is not only can you be sitting in the posture and not be meditating, but you can be washing your dishes and be meditating. And you can do that. You know, I know I've told this story before, but when I first started doing meditation, I had a CD, and it was Daniel Goleman, the guy who wrote Emotional Intelligence, is probably his most famous book. And it was a CD of meditation techniques. And the first one is just like the most basic one. It was like a very light guided meditation. And the first thing he said was, close your eyes. You can't do this meditation while you're driving a car. And I laughed. But then when I started sitting with my eyes open, and when I first started doing that, it was strange because I was used to closing my eyes and kind of getting in a space or whatever. So opening my eyes up, there was stuff. And I came to realize that, you know, one of the stuff that I had was I was sitting on a rug that was an oriental rug. It had a lot of patterns on it. And if I was sitting there looking and I was looking too hard, the patterns would start to shimmer and move. And I was like, whoa. So stuff was there. And I realized, I'm sure it was brought to my attention, but it's very true, is our practice, unlike the one where you close your eyes and you can't drive the car, our practice, you can do it anywhere. Because it's not about shutting out reality in any way whatsoever, right? We do sit facing a wall to try to minimize distraction, but we're not closing eyesight out. We're not closing any of our senses out, right? We're just being fully present with what it is that's showing up without the distractions or with as few distractions as possible. We realize that it's actually not, you know, I said without distractions, and that makes it sound like there's stuff out there that's distracting us, but that's not really what's distracting us. That's what reducing distractions helps us to see, is that really what's happening is our mind grabs hold of objects, you know, and that's what we call distraction, is we're attaching to things. We're making something out of this. We take our experience to be a particular way. So that's what I think Dogen is pointing out, is that it's neither just sitting, taking up the posture, nor is it limited to just sitting. Like any part of our life is this practice. With Zen practice, we do this anywhere. And so there's another term that gets used sometimes to talk about this sitting, just because it's not about all the forms. It's really just about fully living this. And that is shikantaza, which is a word you might hear, and it might sound, you know, sometimes the way I think I initially understood it was like a more pure version of zazen, but I think it's just doing zazen. It's hitting zazen directly on the nose, is what shikantaza is. It's not another step. There's not more technique that you layer. In a way, it's complete lack of technique. So you can do shikan. Well, taza is referring to meditation, right? That's what the za in Taizé I was referring to. It's actually talking about sitting there because Zazen, but that's shorthand for Zazen. Shikan Taizé. Shikan, I'll just read to you what Dainin Katagiri wrote about this because it's, I think it's very helpful. He goes, Shikan is translated as wholeheartedness. He said, this is interesting to me, which seems to be some sort of psychological state or pattern, wholeheartedness, something that we can go, oh yeah, that's that. When I'm in that frame of mind, I'm wholehearted. But Katagiri goes on, he goes, Shikan is not a psychological pattern. Shikan is exactly becoming one with the process itself. So whatever it is we're doing is becoming one with that as it is unfolding. And he says, literally, Za of Taza is Zazen. And Ta means to hit. So from moment to moment, we have to hit the bullseye of Zazen itself. This is not a technique. In the sword practice of Kendo, one has to hit right in the middle of the opponent's head to get a point. This is not a technique. It is the practice that has been accumulated day after day. Our practice must be very deep, unfathomable. And that's just, it sounds like, oh, how am I going to do that? But if you just sit and you don't layer the stuff over, that's the unfathomableness right there. And then we can hit the bullseye, Katagiri says. Shikan is exactly taza full devotion to Zazen itself, that is, to the process itself and not to a concept. So that's it. Right there. Don't mess with it. Right? Zazen is a ripe peach. Right? It's right here. You know, we know those peaches are ripe for like 2 weeks. I could almost talk about bananas because to me they're even worse. A banana is to me ripe for about 2 minutes. And then it's inedible after that. But a ripe peach, you only got this window of time where you've got your ripe peach. That's right there. Exactly it. Ripe. Right there. And that's really what this moment is. And this is what our practice is. Right here. Right here. Right exactly here is ripe. Nowhere else. Right now is exactly right, but it's no one else. It's just right here. It's perfect, and it needs no mustn't fussin'. You just need to be present to enjoy it. So we need to be present and awake to it because it's always here. It's always here, and we feel like it's not. We feel like it's not ripe, and we got to do something. But the ripe peach is always right, exactly right here. If we can be awake to it. And that's just settling into it. That's all it is. Nothing fancy. Nothing fancy at all. It's hard for us. We were talking this morning, Annie gave a really nice talk at our chosans, which are these talks we have that are part of practice period. She was talking about just drinking a cup of coffee and how she'd been fully present in drinking that cup of coffee and hadn't quite realized it till somebody else had pointed it out to her because I pointed out because this is so mundane, it's so everyday. This fullness of life is always here. This ripeness of life is just what life is. And it's always happening. And so we think, because we get caught up in our ideas about stuff, we think that when we experience that, it's going to be like, I don't know, party bells going up. Ah, wow, it's going to be wow. But it's not, it's just always there. So as Annie was describing, it's so easy to just go right past because we're looking for wow, fun, awake. Or usually, I mean, it may not be fun, but it's like, and usually when you're doing that, you've already made something out of it, right? So it's elusive for us when we're trying to grab hold of it, but it's right there if we don't try to grab hold of it. It's right there. We try to grab hold of it. We go right past it because we think it's got to be something more than that, what it actually is, or actually that it has to be something. And that's more than it actually is. So. Well, that's my talk. Thanks for letting me talk about peaches today. Questions or observations or just anything you want to talk about?
I hope someone has a question because I got this really cool new microphone.
Yeah, that is very cool. I call that our Phil Donahue microphone, for those of you old enough to remember Phil Donahue. Yeah, Lois.
How do you feel?
Was it last week? Were you here last week?
I was here last week, yes.
Okay, or was that day the guy from Romanji was here?
Yeah.
Well, this is the same thing. He talked about bouncing a ball.
Yeah.
And you think about like basketball players and they're bouncing the ball and they're looking around the court. And how you can't lose that ball or you're gone, you know? And how it's like the ripe peach, and that's comment.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So basketball was another sport at which I was not good. I wasn't really good at any sport. I was really bad at wrestling when I first did it. My first year that I did wrestling, I think I almost tied one match and then I lost all my other ones. And then I realized that as a left-handed person, I could wrestle differently. And it confused everybody, and so I won half my rounds after that. But basketball was one of those things that I tried, and yeah, thinking about dribbling was not a good thing. You had to kind of just be one with the dribble. Whenever I'd think about it, then I would lose control of the ball. I will say there was one time when I lost control in basketball. Tate, you might appreciate this. Tate enjoys basketball, playing basketball. But I was the ball came to me and I managed to catch it. So what would happen is our coaches would, God bless them, they would put me and my friends out in a game, usually in the last couple minutes of the game, and usually when it was pretty clear that we were going to lose anyhow, right? So he would send me out and then we would just hope that nobody threw the ball at us. And one time somebody threw the ball at me and I caught it. And I panicked because then of course the opposing team came and I panicked and I threw the ball at the hoop and it actually went in. So there are times when losing that control is all right. But yeah, otherwise if you think about it, if your head gets in there, right, now you've got an unripe peach or you've lost control. So thanks for sharing that. Anything else? All right, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.